This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, the politics of fear in Europe. Is the European project in jeopardy? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Countries across Europe have seen nationalist governments rise in popularity, particularly in the wake of the refugee crisis and the terrorist attacks in Paris. Analysts say more than a dozen right-leaning populist parties have scored big gains over the last 2 years. In France, even though the Nationalist Front lost in every region during the second round of recent elections, it still gained the highest number of votes, 7 million, in its 40-year history. And its message of hostility toward immigrants and open borders resonates among large swaths of the public, particularly in the countryside. Parliamentary elections in Poland brought a right-wing government to power, the initial actions of which have sparked a political crisis over who should sit on the country's constitutional tribunal. Moreover, Europe in 2015 faced its most severe migration crisis in centuries, as an estimated 1 million people, mostly Muslims, fled war in Syria and poverty in other countries of the Middle East and Africa and made the complicated trek across Turkey and Eastern Europe to reach Western Europe. With another 3 million migrants and refugees expected in 2016, the mass migration has raised questions about the future of Europe and the ability of its countries to absorb the migrants both culturally and economically. It appears that the combination of the migrant refugee crisis and terrorism on European soil is creating a backlash against Brussels. So how do the terror attacks and refugee crisis affect Europe's system of open borders known as Schengen? What are the implications of the rightward political drift on the social and cultural fabric of the European tapestry? Analysts are asking whether Turkey, a Muslim-majority country, has a place in predominantly Christian Europe. Many on the populist right are increasingly calling for Europe to underscore its Christian roots. Well, with us to discuss the politics of fear and the reasons behind Europe's rightward drift are two distinguished analysts. Alina Polyakova is Associate Director of the Eurasia Center at the Atlantic Council, and that's a Washington-based policy group, and Ivan Vevoda. He's Senior Vice President of Programs at the German Marshall Fund of the United States, and that's a nonprofit organization that aims to strengthen transatlantic cooperation, and it's also based here in Washington. And both guests join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Alina Polyakova, let me begin with you and talk about the European project. Do you think since the horrendous attacks in Paris, where homegrown Islamists may have been radicalized in Syria and pledged allegiance to ISIS, also known as Daesh, and given the refugee crisis, is the European project in peril?
That's a very good question. Just recently, I actually wrote a piece particularly about this project and about what the European dream really means. And the European project, at its core, I would argue, was about inclusive politics and about enlightenment and ideals and egalitarianism. This is what Schengen, as a symbolic system of political freedom of movement, actually symbolizes. So I think now what we're seeing is not a sudden backlash against the European Union. In fact, this backlash has been building. I mean, the right-wing backlash. So even though right-wing parties, particularly Le Pen's National Front, is in the news now, these parties have been becoming part and parcel of European politics for quite some time, and particularly since the economic crisis of 2008. And I think at its core, what this has to do with is with a real crisis of identity within Europe today. What we've seen the European project be very successful at is economic integration and political integration, but has not been very successful at cultural integration. And specifically, this emergence of a European identity that would somehow supersede or transcend national identities has not come to fruition. And what we're seeing now, especially with the fact that younger people are flocking more and more to these populist right-wing groups, is that people are seeking some sense of belonging. And the European Union has not been able to provide that. So I think if we're going to talk about a project in crisis, it's important for us to remember that it is really the cultural identity issues that are in crisis right now.
Turning to you, Ivan Vevoda, for your take on whether or not the European project is in peril.
Well, the project is certainly being most severely challenged in all of its history since the post-World War II. I'd like to add to what Alina said that at origin, the European project is emphatically a political peace project. How does Europe avoid doing war every 20, 25 years? And that is really what galvanized the effort to institutionalize relations, to create buffers so that Europeans, French, and Germans did not need to go to war every few years. And it has been successful during the Cold War. Let's remind ourselves that it was able to do this because of the U.S. security umbrella. And thus, it did not have to invest into its military capacities because the U.S. was there to see that it could defend Europe against the communist Soviet bloc. I would add and really emphasize the economic aspect that Alina mentioned. I think the loss of certainty of the young generation, the fact that politicians do not know how to cope with a situation of rising unemployment and loss of future. So 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds turn to these kinds of parties who are offering typical populist right-wing or sometimes left-wing solutions.
Well, those are excellent responses and really sheds light on the problems. And back to you, Alina Polyakova, to talk about Schengen and the concept of open borders, which is certainly a cornerstone of the European Union. To what extent is this concept being affected or undermined in light of the terrorist attacks and, of course, the refugee crisis?
Well, Schengen, I think, is such a key institution of the European Union. And just going off what Ivan just mentioned about the young generation. So on the one hand, we've seen huge unemployment rates in the countries most affected by the economic crisis, upwards of 50% in places like Greece for young people between the ages of 18 and 34. These are huge numbers. And we have similarly high numbers, not as high as 50% places like Italy and Portugal and Spain. And what this really shows us is that the new Europeans are disgruntled with the European project's promises. They're not going to see the same level of social mobility that their parents have had, for example. And these young people could really become the next lost generation of Europe. Now, I think that being said, on the other hand, young people have also taken for granted a lot of the positive developments of the European Union. And one of them is, of course, Schengen. I think many young people born in the 90s can't imagine having to show their passport at the border when they go on their study abroad year or when they go for vacation in some other European country. And what we have seen over the last, say, two decades has been a mass movement of individuals across countries for work, for holidays. More and more young people speak foreign languages today than they did in the previous generation. English has become the lingua franca of Europe for young people specifically. So I think we are seeing, on the one hand, two very opposing trends. One is that young people are becoming Europeans, in a sense, through all of these processes of moving around countries, interacting with their peers in other countries very easily because of Schengen and other such institutions in the Eurozone. On the other hand, feeling completely disgruntled by the failed promises of the European economic dream. So now we're seeing this move by the European Union to restrict Schengen, to increase potential border controls. We've seen some individual European member states build fences across their borders, for example. Others have proposed this. Hungary, of course, comes to mind. France closed its borders temporarily as well after the attacks. And I think this has the potential to set a very, I'll say, negative precedent for Europe's continued future as actually an open society free for movement and labor. And I think that would be a mistake.
Turning to you, Ivan Vevoda, for your take on Schengen, to what extent it's being undermined, and how can Europe strike a balance between the need for security and the need to remain open and to give young people a hope for the future?
Absolutely. And as Alina said, the Schengen, or rather the free movement within Europe, is really one of the greatest achievements and has helped to begin to create some sense of community, even though I agree with Alina on the fact that, you know, there is no European people. There isn't a European demos. But that's due to European history. And in fact, what we're seeing through these processes that we've mentioned is a renationalization of politics. So there's an inward turn. There's more what in European Union parlance is called intergovernmentalism, i.e. it's the governments that are discussing between themselves bilaterally rather than at the level of Brussels. And even as these tendencies are strengthened, there is still, and I would here single out Germany and France, obviously, that are trying to keep that sense that the community is still there and needs to find common solutions. That's what everyone agrees on, that, you know, there is no single country solution. There's only a common solution to these issues that we're tackling. Schengen, and let's remind ourselves, these are temporary closures of borders. I don't want to underestimate the problem, yes. But everybody is saying that because everybody knows the value of Schengen. Sweden has introduced controls. Denmark just announced that it will also probably introduce those controls. I want to underscore that Hungary was really the first and kind of the bad pupil in the class, because building razor wire fences 25 years after the fall of the wall, when Hungary was really at the avant-garde of breaking down these walls, is really troublesome. And so various countries did various things. I would also like to say that even though there is the rise of these movements, it's interesting to note that in Germany, we do not have this yet. And, you know, we can go into specifics. There are, of course, the Pegida movement, the very populist right-wing movement, especially in the east of Germany, and then the party called the Alternative for Germany that began as an anti-Euro party and that now has become populist, but still not garnering enough votes. And finally, I think it's important to note, and we saw this in the second round of the French election, that there was a mobilization against these parties, and Marine Le Pen did not win any region in France. So let's not totally doom and gloom this without underestimating the danger, which is real.
Indeed. We'll have more on this in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Alina Polyakova. She's Associate Director of the Eurasia Center at the Atlantic Council, a Washington-based policy group, and Ivan Vevoda. He's Senior Vice President of Programs at the German Marshall Fund of the United States, and that's a think tank dedicated to strengthening transatlantic cooperation, also based here in Washington. We're discussing the viability of the European Union as the terrorist attacks in Paris and the refugee crisis test its fundamental tenets of tolerance and open borders. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel, VOA, or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout-out to loyal listener Ida Tekin from Turkey. Teşekkür ederim. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send us an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us on Facebook. Well, back to you, Alina Polyakova, to continue our discussion about the open borders and the driftward to the right, notwithstanding what Ivan just said about Germany and the fact that Marie Le Pen's Front National did not win in the regional elections at the end of the day, and that Angela Merkel is still very strong in her principles with respect to the union and migration. Still yet, we have this refugee crisis. Why does it seem so difficult, in your view, for the EU to find a common solution to this crisis?
I wish I could be a fly in some of those negotiations within the European Council and the European Commission, to be honest with you. But this is something that's part and parcel of European politics. There are 28 countries that have to reach a decision, and many countries have trouble reaching decisions and their own national politics. So this is part and parcel of democracy. And I think in many ways, I would venture to say that the original founders of the European Union back in the 1950s, when it was primarily a war prevention and economic community based on free trade of coal specifically, did not see these kinds of conflicts coming up in the future. But these are the regular proceedings of democratic states. So if we look at the European Union more as a democratic state with 28 different members within it, which is exactly what it is, these conflicts should not come as a surprise. It's difficult to reach consensus solutions, particularly on something as divisive as how many refugees a particular country is willing or not willing to accept, given its own economic conditions. Because one thing that we have to remember about the structure of the European Union is, of course, while there's the Eurozone, the common currency, there's the open borders and Schengen, each country is responsible for its own social programs, for the welfare state. This is not an EU-wide policy, and it's very much been resisted by the individual member states to have some sort of EU-wide policy when it comes comes to social welfare and EU-wide regulations related to that. So every single country has a very different system, and that, of course, determines the number of immigrants they're institutionally able to absorb.
Turning to you, Ivan Vejvoda, for your take on why it seems to be so difficult for the EU to find a common solution to this very critical issue, the refugee crisis. It sort of makes you wonder, if Hungary or some of the Eastern European countries do not have the resources, then why is there not a mechanism at the Brussels level to then provide them with those resources if this is a continent-wide issue? Your take.
Absolutely. I'd start out by saying that we're in a bit of a situation of a perfect storm here, to remind ourselves that basically there are three crises that Europe is confronting at this moment. First of all, there was the Eurozone crisis, which is still ongoing. This has not been resolved. Secondly, there was the Russian incursion, invasion, and annexation of the territorial sovereignty of Ukraine by taking the Crimean Peninsula. Huge change in the order that was established or seemed to be established after 1989. And then finally, you have this huge, huge wave unseen in recent times. Of course, there were such waves after World War II, the Yugoslav wars. There were lots of movements, hundreds of thousands of people were displaced, etc. But this magnitude, let's remind listeners that Germany has now taken in officially 1 million people. Sweden is the country that has taken most of these refugees per capita of their population. So these are humongous efforts. So Europe is confronting these three. The second important thing to say, Europe was created, institutions were created, but they were never finalized, to speak very simply. So the euro does not have all the mechanisms. There is not a fiscal union in Europe. After the crisis started, they introduced a banking union, various stabilization mechanisms. The same goes for these issues of internal justice and home affairs issues. The so-called Dublin Agreement, without going into detail, worked well in peaceful times. So when you're in a crisis, you see what are the institutional mechanisms that you're lacking. Europe has always, up until now, colloquially put, muddled through. Mm-hmm. It's always found small steps of how to reinforce those institutions that were lacking in mechanisms. It is doing the same thing now, but confronted with a much, much bigger challenge. That's part of the answer to your question. And those of us who follow see that slowly they have been doing this. So there has been a meeting with Turkey, for example. Turkey is a key country here, which holds roughly 2 million of these refugees. It has been offered $3 billion in aid to help them stay there. Turkey has reopened a new chapter of negotiations, and there's visa-free travel that's being put on the table if Turkey meets those conditions. Let's remind ourselves also that there was a meeting of the leaders of Europe with African leaders in Malta just about 2-3 weeks ago because, and this is little known, we talk about Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey, but in fact, countries like Kenya, Ethiopia, roughly about 2 million more refugees just waiting to start going north through Libya, etc. And thus the meeting with the Africans was the same scheme. Offer money so that these refugees can have some vocational training, keep them there. What I'm saying is there's a cascade effect of trying to solve this issue. And finally, there was a meeting with Western Balkan leaders, the so-called mini Western Balkan summit, also about 4 weeks ago, where it was agreed that Greece would keep 50,000 refugees temporarily and Serbia and Macedonia 50,000, also with, again, added resources. So the issue is being solved piecemeal. It starts looking like initial steps of a more global solution, and in particular, external border control. I'd like to finish with that. At this European Council summit this Thursday and Friday, there was discussion about making this so-called Frontex, the European External Border Control Police, beefing it up to 1,200, because you have a country like Greece that has an extremely complicated border.
Absolutely. Well, Ivan Vejvoda of the German Marshall Fund, you gave a very good and comprehensive answer, and you brought up Turkey, and I'm going to turn to that. Back to you, Alina Polyakova. To talk about the deal with Turkey, certainly they have so many refugees, they have been very magnanimous in harboring them, and suddenly now the European Union, although was a little bit circumspect about talking with Turkey with respect to accession, now the European Union needs Turkey on the refugee issue. Talk about the impact of that, though. If Turkey does comply, which it seems to be doing in return for the $3 billion in aid, what impact will that have on Turkey's talks to join the European Union, and won't some of the right-wing populist parties want to push back on that? And what will be the effect you know, on the youth? Are they in favor of this kind of rapprochement? Because you have, of course, those Syrians that are staying or other refugees that are staying in Turkey. You still have the migrant crisis, and what effect will that have on unemployment? Many are saying these are very skilled people. They will only add to Europe's economic success because of the declining, you know, demographic issue. Again, just your take on all of these issues.
It's a complex set of questions. I think on the one hand, we have to take a step back to really think about, is European expansion still even on the table, to be honest with you? Yes, of course, countries like Turkey have been on that path of accession for quite some time now. The current negotiations regarding the refugee and immigration numbers and return for aid may change the calculus or may give Turkey more leverage with the European Union. On the other hand, we have countries like Ukraine, which you mentioned earlier, who still, maybe not today, maybe not in 5 years, but very much see themselves as on the path to European integration, countries like Serbia as well. But the question that we have to ask ourselves, is Europe going to be able to expand and really incorporate all of these progressively different countries from the European core countries that were the founders of the European Union? Is the European vision seeing enough success and enough support at the popular level still? And I think that is a real profound question. Is that vision still enough to capture people's imagination enough to support increasing expansion of the European Union? And I think that's an open question. But what we are seeing, to take it back to this question of the far right that we were discussing earlier, is that there's a reason why these parties are finding more and more resonance. And it's exactly because the European dream has been losing its ground, not just with young people, but with the entire European populace. We've seen unprecedented levels of Euroscepticism, as we call it, so anti-Europe EU feelings from the European citizens. And this has been growing, I would say, since 2008. That people are losing the belief that the European Union is good for their countries, that the Eurozone is good for their countries. And even though we don't want to doom and gloom this, as Ivan said, about the rise of the far right and that being a serious threat to the European Union, we should remember that even though in the last municipal election, the National Front did not take any single region in France, across Europe, far-right parties are part and parcel governments. In places like Sweden, the Sweden Democrats are the second largest party. In places like Austria, we have the same case. In Switzerland, which is not an EU member, the Swiss People's Party is the governing party. And this is a trend that has been building over time. And the consequences of that, I think, are still unknown.
Indeed. Well, I'm going to give the last word to you, Ivan Vevoda, to talk about these issues that Alina brought up in terms of, you know, is the vision still there, given all these challenges to the European Union, whether it's rapprochement with Turkey, a predominantly Muslim country, the predominantly Muslim refugees who are coming to Europe, who have the vast majority, probably 99.5%, no ties whatsoever with any, you know, terrorist groups. But, of course, they're causing alarms among, you know, certain communities, particularly on the far right, those who have strong attachment to their Christian roots. They're either scared for reasons that, again, have no basis in actual fact, but they're concerned about their definition of what Europe is. It almost harks back to, you know, World War II, when Jews were considered, at least in some countries, you know, the other. Now, you know, Muslims are coming, seeking refuge. You know, your overall take on the consequences of this and, you know, if Europe can stick together.
Definitely this is and will remain probably the biggest challenge for Europe in decades to come. And the main reason that people see the disgruntlement is that people feel that their benefits are being taken away and given to these incomers. And so because of the economic crisis, people feel their retirement, their entitlements, you know, their health care will be diminished because of these additional people. And that's what we're seeing also in Great Britain with the UKIP movement. In fact, the European Union is now being challenged with what's called Brexit, right? The fact that
yes,
there's a danger that in the referendum, the Brits might vote to leave. And that, I wouldn't underestimate, is something that's also one should add to this list of problems that Europe is confronting. I personally believe that Europe will muddle through this with great difficulty. It will require huge efforts for them to come together. They are coming together. And on the enlargement, I think there are various degrees of enlargement. The Western Balkans are definitely going Serbia Open chapters just this last Monday. Obviously, Turkey is a big challenge because it would be the biggest country in Europe. And I agree with Alina that Ukraine will definitely come online. And I see it as important to add this big and important country to the European Union. So with all caution, realizing how big the challenge is, I believe that Europe again will find it in itself to move forward.
Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter, but I'm sure we will revisit this very important topic in the weeks and months to come. I'd like to thank my guests, Alina Polyakova, she's Associate Director of the Eurasia Center at the Atlantic Council, and Ivan Vevoda, Senior Vice President of Programs at the German Marshall Fund of the United States. Thank you both for your terrific insights.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Rick Pantaleo, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.